Welcome. This is Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. Since Piccadilly Circus has been in the news lately,
it's been lighting up London for more than 100 years, but this morning, Piccadilly Circus went dark.
I figured we'd do something we haven't done since our maiden voyage to London Bridge. Visit an actual location, an icon you can stand on. Unlike London Bridge, a famous name without a famous bridge to represent it anymore, Piccadilly Circus is very much somewhere your typical London tourist is going to go. Now, it would be an exaggeration to say that all roads in London lead to this famous West End intersection, but enough important ones do, guiding you towards it from every direction, that you're likely to stumble upon it before you maybe even mean to. Oh, look at that! I'm already here! Well, I guess I can just cross that off of the Day 2 itinerary. If you come at Piccadilly Circus from the south or the west, like I did the first time, then you emerge from a long colonnade of tall, chalk-white buildings with light blue or light green roofs looming regally on both sides of you, and suddenly you emerge into this assault of kaleidoscopic color. In the foreground, there's a dark fountain, and it wears dozens of tourists and locals on its stairs like a colorful skirt. There's probably a crowd gathered around a magician or breakdancers right behind it. And then, in the background, a widescreen Technicolor experience. The screen is massive, and it's convex. It practically reaches out to you. And because of this, it takes up so much of your eye real estate that you can barely look away. But just for a moment, do look away. Look down at the flow of traffic. Because everything around the fountain and south of it is pedestrianized, and because there's an island in the middle of the circus for pedestrians to wait while crossing, the traffic pattern here is intricately baffling. From above, from your Google Maps view, the streets of Piccadilly Circus look like a fancy A. Almost exactly like the Atlanta Braves A, actually, with the top of the A getting sucked northwest into the elegant curve of Regent Street. The only intersection in the world that would look like this is one that really had no other choice, that sort of evolved piecemeal into this. The fact is, Piccadilly Circus is just as confounding as London Bridge in its own ways, and the reasons are largely the same. The crush of humanity that needs to pass through here on foot and by vehicle has necessitated countless changes that have led to this, a circus that is decidedly not circular. And yes, that is what circus means in this case, and I did have to look that up. We'll skate pretty quickly past the obvious misunderstanding. Wayne's World 2 got there almost 25 years ago.
Here we are at Piccadilly Circus.
Wow, what a shitty circus.
Good call. There's no animals or clowns. What a ripoff.
We're not going to be able to add anything new, other than to mention that the etymological origins of both of the meanings are the same. Circus, as in rounded intersection, and circus, as in... Well, they both come from the Greek word kirkos for circular. And we can thank Philip Astley, father of the modern circus, and his round equestrian ring for the more popular modern definition of the word. Honestly, even if you are thinking of the right kind of circus, Piccadilly Circus is a pretty shitty circus. If anything, at this point it is more three-ring circus with street performers surrounded by clapping tourists than roundabout circus. It did start out as one in 1819, but everything was derailed 67 years later, when a new road was added to act as a really critical avenue that would head northeast towards Charing Cross Road. The result was the triangle where Ripley's Believe It or Not sits today. And that created a persistent asymmetry that has frustrated the heck out of just about every person we will meet for the rest of the episode. In 1893, sculptor Alfred Gilbert called Piccadilly Circus
a distorted isochromal triangle square to nothing of its surroundings, an impossible sight, in short, upon which to place any outcome of the human brain, except possibly an underground lavatory.
And that's tame compared to the opening to an 1890s piece by author Alan Upward in The Idler.
The most horrible place in London is Piccadilly Circus. Londoners themselves do not know this. They are not ashamed of their circus. They even swagger about it. They claim that it is a good, well-executed, round circus. They swear by the place. It is their fetish. They talk as if Piccadilly Circus were the keyhole by which the world is wound. All this is simply ridiculous. Piccadilly Circus is not a good circus. A board school child could draw a better circus on his slate. Trained geometricians, when they hear this place called a circus, laugh. Their science teaches them to do so. The fact is that this thing is not a circus at all. It is a badly made trapezium. Hades is a better circus than this third-rate fraud.
And all of this was before half the circus was turned into open pedestrian space, forcing all the traffic into the northern half. I cannot even imagine what Gilbert or Upward might have said about today's circus, which has changed dramatically since their day. What's remarkable is what has changed. Unlike its American cousin, Times Square, and if we are going to be insistent on accurate names, Times Square is not very square. Well, anyway, Times Square loses century-old buildings constantly, so high-rise hotels can be built. But in Piccadilly Circus, most of the buildings that Gilbert or Upward would have known in the 1890s are still there. The triangular London Pavilion that now houses Ripley's, and the Criterion Theatre and Restaurant, and of course, the curved building that once housed the Café Monaco, not that anyone very much cares what's inside that building anymore. For the record, it's a gap, so people who need jeans urgently might care. And the reason for that is, alright, fine, I give you permission to look back up from the traffic pattern again. The most iconic part of this very iconic public space is the illuminated advertising that hugs the upper stories of the Monaco building. Even more than the traffic pattern, this conglomerate of adverts has evolved ceaselessly to keep up with the times, and today, it's undergoing another major overhaul, with the 6 already massive LED screens being taken down to be replaced by 1 gargantuan board later this year. It's the longest the circus has been without its definitive nightlights since the Blitz, and there's a nervous anticipation for what comes next. Some of the changes outlined in a Business Matters article sound pretty darn impressive. Part of the future-proofing... Wow, that word. Okay, part of the future-proofing will include localized Wi-Fi, which will mean that, quote,
Coca-Cola, for example, can log on at any given moment, see a large group of Spanish tourists, and change the copy of the ad from hello to buenos dias.
Pretty cool. But there's also the potential for future-proofing so much that the magic of the past is completely lost. The incredible thing about advertising in the circus is that it sprouted up willy-nilly, and no matter how cutting-edge the technology has been, and no matter how much the advertising real estate shrank, there was always this patchwork quilt. But now, no matter how much one screen mimics 6 screens, it's still gonna be just one screen. We'll simply have to wait and see on that one, and rest assured that Piccadilly Circus is that rare London icon where the inevitability of change is a feature, and not a bug. To really see the truth in that statement, we have to see how Piccadilly Circus can change across a lifetime. But not your lifetime. That's too easy. We are very good at recognizing how our world has changed, but we tend to flatten the differences between long ago decades because we didn't live them. So, if you'll allow me to get a bit transcendental, let's visit one of your past lives. 1893. The Sculptor.
Do you know who the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury was?
You turn from the fountain, your hands dipped in, ready to take a sip of cool, fresh water, quite a commodity. And you see a dark-haired, handsome man, a few years older than your father. Why he's asking a young child, an 8-year-old, this, that's an open question. He seems lonely and a bit sad. You think about giving some cheeky answer like, I'd say he's the first son of the 6th Earl of Shaftesbury, Governor. But then again, looking at his desperate eyes, you can tell that a serious answer will mean a lot to him. Like, if you can show him that someone young knows this fact, maybe a weight will be lifted off his shoulder. Maybe he's related to the Earl. So you really think about it. Just as you're ready to give up and shake your head no, you're struck. This is the Shaftesbury Memorial Fountain. See, you point triumphantly up above the basin full of drinking water, and up above the second basin where no water shoots at all, up to the shiny, winged man with the bow perched precariously atop the whole edifice. That would make the most sense if that were the Earl. And who knows, maybe Earls have wings. You've never met an Earl. The melancholy man sighs. Wrong answer. He pats one of the steps leading up to the basin, beckoning you to sit as he sits.
He was a friend of the poor, and encouraged all sorts of labor, which should help them to help themselves. The Earl had the betterment of the masses at heart, and I know that he thought deeply about the feminine population and their employment.
The man describes a life lived fully, and in the service of others. Anthony Ashley Cooper, Lord Ashley, born in 1801, a parliamentarian who reformed lunacy laws which were completely inhumane before he took action, a devout Christian man who publicly supported Zionism, a state for the Jews in the Holy Land, even though no other politician would touch that, and who made sure little 8-year-old children like you would never have to work, especially as miners or chimney sweeps, and that children older than you wouldn't be able to work more than 9 hours and would have to go to school. The Earl died the year you were born, 1885, and this wide street that you're facing, with the gravity-defying signs for the Monaco and Mellon's Food on the left, and the new London Pavilion on the right, that was built that same year, and it was named in his honor. Shaftesbury Avenue. And now, in 1893, there is this memorial fountain, unveiled earlier in the year. You turn to look up at it, wondering if it does service to this great man, and the man next to you scoffs.
Why not pull down the whole work and reduce it to copper, of which metal there are hundreds of pounds worth, and place the sum realized by the sale to a nucleus fund to provide night shelters for the poor creatures who year in and year out congregate on the embankment nightly.
You look over at the man in shock. He smiles weakly.
I am the unfortunate author of the fountain.
That actually makes sense. Oh no. How unfortunate for this guy. You may not know much about the Earl this fountain memorializes, but everyone knows that the fountain itself has been less than a success. For one, as Alan Upward will put it in a few years.
As a fountain, its fault is that it does not fount.
The sculptor, Alfred Gilbert, he tells you about how, thanks to the inabilities of the various councils who run various parts of this circus, to come to an agreement, The entire edifice, the basin and the foundation, they were all forced to be much smaller than Gilbert had wanted. So the upper jets, which were supposed to dance about the sculpture, are never on. And the lower jets that feed the water basin are pathetic. Because otherwise, the fountain splashes the street. Speaking of splashing, the fountain quickly became infamous for the gang of neighborhood children who spat suddenly plentiful clean water at each other and at others. There's been a park keeper posted at the fountain ever since, and the one who's on duty right now eyes you warily. He's right, too. You did your fair share of spitting. And then there were the cups. To represent the Earl's charitable spirit, 8 beautiful golden cups had been chained to the fountain's basin at its unveiling. Which sounds great, but to the people of the neighborhood, they were just really valuable cups. You don't have the heart to tell the sculptor that you know many of the people who absconded with those cups. By the day after the unveiling, only 2 of those cups remained chained to the fountain. Well, 2.5, actually. One was left behind, smashed in the fountain. That one may have been a statement about how someone felt about the fountain's artistic merits. And then, flashes of some of the things you've heard said about the fountain.
Ugly, pretentious, unsuitable, and a decided nuisance, so that it is devoutly to be hoped that the entire memorial will shortly follow the lost cups, and that something more worthy of the great and good Earl will be erected in its place.
The figure on the summit is hideous, indecent, and ludicrous.
The dreadful monument in Piccadilly is the work of somebody who has no idea of the dignity of design and the simplicity that mark all pure design.
A dripping, sickening mess. The feeble squirts which discharge themselves round the Shaftesbury fountain are as ludicrous and contemptible as anything to be found in Trafalgar Square.
The best thing that can be done with it is to return the bronze to the melting furnace.
One of, if not the very ugliest, monuments that can be found in any capital in Europe.
Gilbert laughs mirthfully and says that he should have just made them the stupid coat and trousers statue that they wanted. But no, he says, he went and told them when they first approached him,
I can't undertake the statue of Lord Shaftesbury. I prefer something that will symbolize his life's work. The life of Lord Shaftesbury lent itself to that rather than the glorification of the tailor. Besides,
and here Gilbert winks,
the sum mentioned emboldened me to suggest such an undertaking, being more than 3 times what I had asked for a simple statue.
But, in the end, this project was, he confides,
financially, a great debacle. The government said they would give me old guns to be melted down for metal, a promise that was not kept.
Ultimately, Gilbert paid out of his own pocket for the metal, including the aluminium used for the sculpture atop the fountain, probably the first such use of that metal for a permanent sculpture like this one. The figure of Eros, well, actually, it's his twin brother Anteros who represents selfless love, but no one will ever get that right. Eros could never have leaned out so spectacularly, perched on only 1 tiny leg if he'd been made from bronze like the rest of the fountain. Gilbert was paid a hefty £3,000 to make this fountain, but he spent more than double that. And now he isn't even involved with the fountain anymore at all, even though it still desperately needs improvements. He points at the low wall with 4 openings that surrounds the staircase you sit on, and tells you that not long ago, he had recommended that the openings be closed, and that this entire area be turned into another basin so that the jets could spray freely. An idea that was met with much enthusiasm until it was rejected. Now, he's angry, though still quiet. Sad.
The suggestion which the council did not see their way to adopt is the only one of any importance. They have deliberated upon detail,
when the larger issue was in question. For I hold that this curtailment of my original intention is the very cause of all the trouble. Surely, it is a travesty upon all that is reasonable and just that an artist is to be dictated to by those who have never done aught but talk and criticize that of which they have no conception. It is now between the county council and me. They may beat me by the majorities who side with them, yet I will stand alone. If it must be, let them take the fountain down, it will content them, and I shall be contented and not hurt by such a victory as will be this. I must have absolutely a free hand, otherwise I stir no farther in the matter.
The sculptor gets up, looks toward the sun, squinting at his memorial.
Since the ceremony of unveiling, I have had the painful experience of witnessing the utter failure of my intention and design. I designed the fountain so that some sort of imitation of foreign joyousness might find place in our cheerless London. I have been doomed to disappointment from start to finish. I not only ruined myself, but I have brought upon my head periodical attacks on my poor work.
He turns and leaves you there, on the steps of his fountain. He wasn't wrong about his ruination. Within a few years, he would be bankrupt, fleeing to an unglamorous life in Belgium. But ultimately, his fortunes would improve, around the same time as those of his most famous work. In the mid-20s, the monument was moved so a tube station could be built under it, and during the fountain's 6 years in Embankment Gardens, it became a subject of fascination. And around the same time, Gilbert re-established himself in Rome, and made enough money to return to England a respected old artist. And he was knighted before his death at 80 in 1934. The Song. You're thinking of Mr. Gilbert, the sculptor. You've heard he lives on the continent. How must he be faring with the war raging in nearby Belgium? When you hear it for the first time, one of the Irish regiments is singing. Many battalions sing, but this is a bit strange. The Irish regiments don't sing very often. But the second company of Connaught Rangers are belting as their boat approaches Boulogne, and as they march through Boulogne. They're singing a song you've never heard before.
It's a long way to go. It's a long way.
Where Tipperary is, you have no idea. Somewhere in Ireland is probably a good guess. But when they get to the lines, "Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square."
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.
It's only been 9 days since Britain declared war on Germany. August 4th, 1914. 9 days ago. She threw her hat into the ring, and in those 9 days, you've packed up. You're in France now. You want to do your part for your country. And already you miss her so. Piccadilly Circus, your old haunt, the heart of London town, where the Tony shops to the west and Regent and Piccadilly run headlong into the bawdy theaters to the east in Soho. It's seared into your memory. Literally, seared. It is bright. There is no greater testament to the monopoly electricity has on the human imagination than Piccadilly Circus. What started in your childhood at the corner of the new Shaftesbury Avenue, well, corner probably isn't the best term, since those large sky signs at Mellon's and Monaco careened from the roofs of that round building. Well, now it's turned into an all-out competition, and it's not just about big anymore, but blinding, incandescent light bulbs, And it's not just the stores advertising their own names anymore. In 1908, an electric drink Perrier water sign was mounted above the Café Monaco entrance, and come on, every building owner in the circus was dreaming of all the pounds they could make. Technically, they weren't supposed to do it. There were rules in place regulating lamps and signs that hung over the public way. The councils had forced down those sky signs in 1898 for exactly that reason. And so down came the giant melons and Monaco signs that had touched the clouds. But in their place were illuminated signs that were attached directly to the frontages of buildings. Mr. Joseph, the lessee on the Piccadilly Mansions, for instance, he had asked for permission twice to put up illuminated signs, figuring, so many exceptions had been made already. That one doesn't technically hang out over the street and such. But he was refused. So guess what? He did it anyway. He hung up the signs, and no one did anything about it for 4 years. And then last year, 1913, the London County Council took legal action. And they lost! And good thing, too. Hypocrites they were. At the same time that they were taking action on Mr. Joseph for his signs, they were giving permission to the Board of Trade to put up 21-foot illuminated signs advertising the International Exhibition at Ghent, right across the street on the London Pavilion. Well, now Mr. Joseph's signs have been there for years, and the Board of Trade isn't the only one that can see the potential. The circus is so wide, so open, especially where Shaftesbury Avenue turned the square into a trapezoid. You can see a big sign from anywhere in the circus, like an actor on a stage in a theater where there are no bad seats. There they are, vivid in your mind, spelled out in light bulbs, 8 feet high. Bovril and Schweppes. You're sure that in no time, that whole corner will be illuminated signs lighting up the night sky. Not the south and west sides of the circus that are owned by the Crown, they'll never allow that. But now that the London County Council has shown they're weak, who knows what magic that brands will be able to make out of light bulbs. And you'll be missing it. But buck up. You'll have plenty of Bovril, that most British of meat paste, in the meantime. Fresh meat will be hard to come by in the coming months. This war should only take a few months, right? So Bovril will be a staple on the front. Take a cow carcass, heat it up, and then mix the liquid runoff with powdered dry meat. There's Bovril. Put it on bread, put it in stews, mix it with hot water and drink it. Bovril is versatile. And if anyone didn't know about it before, though that seems impossible, everyone knows Bovril, Piccadilly Circus will change that now. On the steps of the Boulogne Hotel, within earshot of you, a woman and a man marvel at the song that has turned these reminiscences into hot tears.
What is it they are singing?
I don't know. It's possibly a new song of our music halls.
But the words, monsieur?
Madame, they sing, "It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go."
That man is journalist George Kernock. And he's right. This is a music hall song of recent vintage, written well before the outbreak of the war, as "It's a Long Way to Connemara" back in 1909, and changed to "Tipperary" to win a bet in 1912. It's popular enough. But thanks to Kernock, who will share the lyrics and his impressions in the Daily Mail, this will become the definitive song of this war. And "Goodbye, Piccadilly, Farewell, Leicester Square" will become part of the lexicon. ...1944... the blackout. How did this happen again? This wasn't supposed to happen again. Christmas Eve on year 6 of the Second World War. 6 years since so many more young folks said, "Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell Leicester Square. 6 years since the circus was last lit up at night. Its massive signs advertising Bovril and Guinness and Gordon's Gin, no exception to the blackout meant to make things a bit harder for German bombers. 6 years since Gilbert's Eros sculpture. Well, Antiros, but when you tell people that, you sound like a contrarian, so you've just given up. 6 years since it was moved to a safe warehouse, and the rest of the Shaftesbury Memorial Fountain was boarded up in a way that makes it look like something out of a science fiction space picture. It all reminds you of a documentary short you saw last year at the cinema.
If I remember rightly, it was about the beginning of this century that the first moving pictures of Piccadilly Circus were taken. You may have seen them, with the statue of Eros, the god of love, in the middle of the circus. He was a landmark until this war began, surrounded at night by a blaze of light. Eros is gone for the present, and those lights with him.
The enthusiastic narrator described Piccadilly thusly.
If you want to know why people are drawn to Piccadilly, just stop and ask some of the thousands who pass there daily, and you'll learn the reasons for their visits are as varied as their home addresses. You see, Piccadilly Circus is more, much more than the center of a city. It's a meeting place for everyone from all over the world.
Looking around Piccadilly this evening, this seems appropriate. It's an impromptu World's Fair. Personnel from every allied nation flock to what they consider the heart of London, and all around you are exhibitions helping Londoners to understand your Soviet allies or your American allies. Not that many people need help with the Americans. Right now, you're muscling your way down Shaftesbury Avenue under the giant Bovril and Schweppes signs, past flocks of young British girls hoping to catch the eye of a handsome American GI. You're struck by a thought as you near the Rainbow Corner, the Red Cross Club that serves American servicemen 24/7. There will always be some people who look at advertising with disdain. People who are glad that the Wrigley's for Vim and Vigor sign on the beautiful London Pavilion building has gone dark. Tacky, vulgar, deceitful advertising. But what are Hollywood movies but advertisements for the glamorous American lifestyle? They're working. Just a few blocks over, in the community of deserters living off the grid in Soho, the spivs who get people what they need through less than honest means completely model themselves after what they see in American movies. The great American bandleader Glenn Miller, who is often at the Rainbow Corner, recently said on the BBC, "We were surprised to find that the British youngsters in the service are so well educated with our American style of music." Well, of course they were, Glenn. No one sold the glamour of their culture like Americans. Looking around you at the throngs of girls dressed in American fashions, hoping to hook an American man, you can tell that the British film industry, a sorry and sad affair through the 30s, the entire British culture industry for that matter, could learn a thing or two about advertising. Come to think of it, what's so wrong with advertising? You turn to look back at where Eros should be, at the boarded-up fountain, and plastered over the boards are posters for war savings. Your money is easy to get at in war savings. Advertising is the reason we weren't wiped out of this war years ago, that we're possibly winning it now. So, sure, plastering giant signs all over the Monaco and the Pavilion is untoward. Until you use those wide, sweeping vistas as an opportunity to tell people to give generously to the Royal Air Force. This corner of Piccadilly Circus has become a forest of girders, light bulbs, and slogans. Practically an art installation in its own right. And you are damn proud of that. You hope you'll be able to see its glow at nighttime again soon. You pass the Monaco and enter the Rainbow Corner. You're too old now to be overseas doing your part, but you volunteer here, down in the basement, Dunker's Den, where waffles and donuts and coffee are served well after all the other restaurants close down at 9. But Before you can get to your station downstairs, you see that everyone is gathered around the radio. Silent. Pale.
Major Glenn Miller, the well-known American band leader, is reported missing. He left England by air for Paris 9 days ago. Major Glenn Miller came over from the States early this year to direct the American band of the AEF, which has often been heard playing in the Allied Expedition Reporters program.
You've seen so much death. Too much. Tomorrow will be an incredible day. You'll get news at Rainbow Corner that American troops under General McAuliffe have held off a Christmas Day advance at Bastogne. A huge, major turning point in the Battle of the Bulge. But this will be a terrible Christmas Eve. Wondering if Glenn Miller, a man who's brought such joy to everyone around you, will be found? If he's in enemy hands? If he's truly gone? The plan. You will die someday. Every person does. You're in your 80s now. You walk through Soho, the epicenter of London youth culture, to Piccadilly, and you feel downright ancient. When you were a child, recorded music and cinema were children too. And now, British music and British cinema...
Bond. James Bond.
They tap out the rhythm of the world's heartbeat. You feel like a scratchy, black-and-white Edison film in a kaleidoscopic Technicolor world. Especially true when you turn onto the circus and pass under the curved neon signs for Skoll and Golden Leader cigarettes and Cinzano. Yeah, after all these years, Bovril is gone. Couldn't keep up with the modern circus, and now you're creaking through throngs of gawkers. Neither can you. This is an inevitable life cycle for a human. You grow old and you die. But an institution like Piccadilly Circus, can it grow old and die? Well, it is sputtering, and it is on death's door. The diagnosis? Its arteries are clogged. You're crossing one of them now, shuffling across the street with an impossible number of pedestrians as an impossible number of cars waits. Traffic needs are anticipated to be too great for the current roundabout to sustain. Too many streets feed into this circus, and too many disperse out from it. Too many Londoners are driving cars now. But that isn't all. Piccadilly is a show, and people want to stop and watch the show. Watch the Coca-Cola sign do its intricate dance.
Coca-Cola. Delicious.
And watch the people who are watching.
Things go better with Coke. Coca-Cola. Delicious.
All these pedestrians pushing against all these cars and all these double-decker buses. It's dangerous. The operative word? Double-decker. That seems to be the new plan. Vehicles on one level, street level, pedestrians on another. There will be an elevated pathway that will be for pedestrians. The cars will go under it. Of course, most of the buildings and the streets will be demolished and replaced with something that can handle all these people and all these cars. So all the buildings you just passed, the curved Monaco, the Pavilion, and the one you're entering now, the Criterion, they'll be gone soon. Eros and his fountain can probably stay. Maybe. This is all pretty much treated as an inevitability. In a recent film called Goodbye Piccadilly, of course it is, the narrator cheerily tells us what will happen to the circus.
But soon Piccadilly Circus will be changing. The entire east side of the circus will be covered at first floor level with pedestrian precincts and walkways. The traffic will pass underneath. The object is to provide space to stand and stare, which can now only safely be done in the early hours.
Upon entering the Criterion restaurant, gilded, opulent, deliriously out of fashion, you're waved over by an old friend. Well, old is relative. When you were in France during the First World War, he was a little boy in South Africa. Now, 60, with his healthy head of hair going white, he looks a bit like a less gaunt Peter Cushing, or an older Christopher Plummer. This is William Holford, Baron Holford for 14 years now, knighted for his work as an architect and town planner. It's his name, Holford, that's on the plan to overhaul Piccadilly. He's been working on it for almost a decade now. But at this point, after years of being told to compromise his vision for a pedestrian-friendly piazza so that more car traffic can be accommodated and maybe more car traffic and, hey, just a suggestion, even more car traffic, it seems to you like William is finally drawing a line in the sand. He laments his inability to push his plans through, saying that now, unless you're prepared to behave like a prima donna, you just can't get anything done. No one will heed his advice.
Plan Piccadilly for people rather than cars.
Holford's original plan had been to create a grand piazza, an open, multi-tiered public space strikingly reminiscent of something out of Disneyland's Tomorrowland. But all that the various committees and ministers of government could say in response was, additional traffic capacity, additional traffic capacity. And he gave in, and he gave in, until what was left was this. People shuffling by on walkways, looking down, if they would even want to, at an efficient traffic intersection. You're reminded of something another old friend, the theater critic W.J. McQueen Pope, once said.
Traffic has destroyed more of London than enemy bombs.
It is incredible to think that the circus survived German bombs, but it might be destroyed now by traffic capacity. You wonder what Popey would think of the plan. One of the last things that he did before passing away in 1960 was finish an immense history of Piccadilly that also served as his pseudo-memoir as well. He called it, of course, Goodbye Piccadilly. William Holford interrupts you from your reverie. He is convinced, he says, that if Piccadilly Circus is to remain something more than a name on the underground map of London, the solution must be to regulate or relieve motor traffic, probably outside the circus itself.
If the minister's decision is accepted by the council, and has the effect which it seems to me it must have on the comprehensive scheme already prepared, then this scheme and any minor modifications of it will be valueless as an instrument of planning control, and would be better withdrawn. In that case, I must clearly, although with very great regret, resign the council's commission.
And in that moment, you're reminded of another great artist and thinker who labored on the circus for years, dealing with its strange traffic-averse shapes, who was stymied repeatedly by the inability of various committees to make decisions, and who gave and gave and gave until he could give no more. He made that fountain outside, the one the government went out of its way to protect during the Blitz. Alfred Gilbert didn't live to see his work sanctified in such a manner, and the man sitting across from you now, William Holford, will not live to see the circus's ultimate fate. He will pass away in 1975, 4 years before the quote-unquote least change plan is decided on. Pretty simple, actually. Just turn everything from the fountain down to the Criterion into sidewalk. Pedestrians can gather around street performers there, and, well, the cars will get the north half of the circus. The curve, the ads, the pavilion, they'll all stay. This era, these 20-some-odd years from the proposed demolition of the Monaco building for an office block in 1954 to the least change solution, they'll be best summed up by The Observer in 1973.
Piccadilly Circus, more than anywhere else in the country, is a place for the people.
It is not, first of all, a traffic junction, nor an office centre. It is somewhere people go to wander about, gop and gossip, and generally amuse themselves. Those who have drawn up successive plans for its redevelopment have failed to understand its real nature, and one after the other, their efforts have been laughed to scorn.
But looking across from you at William Holford, you see someone deserving of neither laughter nor scorn. Sure, if he'd have his way, this restaurant you're in now, almost 100 years old, it would be wiped away. But Piccadilly Circus has never been against progress in the past. So much of what makes it unique, so picturesque, so theater-like, came because countless buildings and streets were demolished in 1885. Now, here before you sits a man who was presented with an actual problem, an intersection that could not let enough people through, and who tried always to champion the people's right to keep what they had now. An open public place, an interchange of ideas, a showstopper.
Alright, welcome back to 2017. Hopefully, that trip to a past life has shown us that Piccadilly Circus is a very unique sort of icon. Icons tend to ascend to that iconic status because they remind us of grander times. Big Ben, the Eiffel Tower, the pyramids. We would never future-proof those icons. If anything, we past-proof them, making sure they remain evocative of when they were built. But Piccadilly Circus, bless it, has never had a chance to calcify. It was important because people said it was important, and they kept going there no matter what it looked like, even if the planning director of the Westminster Council called it little more than a down-at-heel, neon-lit slum. Through incandescent light bulbs, and then neon, and now LED, people have gawked at the most expensive advertising space in the world. We don't go to Piccadilly Circus because it tells us about the past. We go because it tells us about the future. Down to the simplest of questions, what will I be buying tomorrow? And to do that, the circus has to keep changing. If it ever stops changing, then it betrays us. The weirdest aspect of this is that the circus has probably never looked more like it did in 1893 than it does today, traffic pattern aside. And not just because the LED board is down until November. Look at the place where the curved board will go. As LED screens go, it's going to be massive. But compared to what advertising in Piccadilly Circus looked like in 1954 when Coca-Cola showed up, it's a major downgrade. Ads once completely covered the Monaco building and the pavilion across the way. Wherever there was an iota of space, there was room for another neon ad. It was the Wild West of great advertising art, with 30 or 40 different fiefdoms of various sizes and wattages competing for attention and, down the line, pounds. Now, we'll be down to just one board. And yeah, sometimes it'll be made to look like six boards. And sometimes it'll just shout at you with all its might, "Buy Coke."
Like any property that the public warms to, has affection for, and knows well, to some extent you tamper with it at your own risk,
warns the chairman of the History of Advertising Trust, Graham Hinton.
It's achieved iconic status, and I think the patchwork is really important to it. If you look at the first pictures, it hasn't changed. It's always been that way. At what point does a medium lose its appeal because you adapt it to take advantage of modern technology?
That's the big question. I think we should let the circus's longest-standing resident, aside from Eros, of course, have the final word on what the circus means. Back in 1959, only 5 years after Coca-Cola built its beautiful Piccadilly Circus sign, the company was considering giving up its slot. But understanding the power of big, bold advertising in such a bustling public meeting place, Coca-Cola advertising director Delaney Sledge made the following plea.
I would not, by any faraway stretch of the imagination, do away with the Piccadilly Circus sign. I am sure it has added to the extraordinary quality of Coca-Cola all over the world. It is the type of extraordinary thing which competition has found difficult to match. It is costly, of course, but it is worth the money. If we, in presenting Coca-Cola to our consumers, are content to do ordinary things in an ordinary way, we must of necessity be content to become and remain an ordinary product. Sludge got his way, and in its 64th year in the circus, Coca-Cola will be able to tailor its advertising on Europe's biggest LED screen directly to the people who are watching, based on the language settings on their phones.
I'd like to buy the extraordinary world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey bees and snow white turtledoves.
One note about this episode. Obviously, I cheated a bit with the quotes. Alfred Gilbert and William Holford did not actually say all those things on the same day, or even say all of them aloud. But all those quotes really did come from their own letters and papers, so I hope you enjoyed that glimpse into their personal views. Since this is an episode in part about the beauty of advertising, you hopefully won't begrudge me if I advertise just a little bit. I write, edit, and produce this podcast myself, so if you've liked what you've been hearing from me over the past 8 episodes, let me know. And the best way to do that is to rate and review the podcast in iTunes. I've come to realize this isn't the most intuitive process in the world, so I posted some instructions on the Iconography Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast, to help. iTunes really does use those ratings, through the magic of algorithms, to determine what podcasts get promoted, so if you want to help get Iconography noticed, hit up iTunes. I love doing this podcast, and I hope you love listening to it. I am embarking on a honeymoon to Spain right now that might cause some delays in the production schedule, but that will hopefully leave me so creatively inspired that I come out of it slinging great icons your way. Until then, adios.